I've got snap judgments in plenty of other sports as well, not just footy. So just as well, we've got Robert Craddock with us today for Tyre Power. Your match day favourites for tyre safety. Origin last night, game two, it was in Perth. The Blues came storming back. This was the way it was recorded on Blues Radio on the SEN app.
Cleary, 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 Cleary! It's a party now. Cleary is just carving them up in Perth. Emphatic victory. New South Wales 44 have smashed the Cane Toads 12.
Didn't they? Love it. Now, Robert Craddock, at just a slightly more subdued place, I imagine, Queensland today. Welcome.
It is, Jared. Wayne Bennett used to say, Jared, that when Queensland wins an Origin game, the sun shines brighter through the morning crisp. And he was right. But when they lose, it's the opposite. It was a goddamn miserable morning this morning, even though the sun was out. And it was a thrashing. It really was. And your radio boys caught it, the mood of the day and the player of the night, really. Nathan Cleary, very clever, beautiful kicking game. But the person from an AFL perspective, if you get a chance to watch one highlight, watch Matt Burton's punt in the second half, which spirals higher than any kick I've ever seen in a rugby league field. It is his specialty. He puts it up there into the swirling breeze. If there had been in summer, the Fremantle doctor would have caught it and wobbled it. But it was just incredible. And it's a dangerous weapon, this super high punt. I've never seen anything like it.
So there's a few elements to it. The first was Perth, 59,368, which further enshrines what a national phenomenon a game between New South Wales and Queensland is.
Yeah, it was. Look, there was a lot of interstate travellers who sort of took the chance for a Perth holiday, and I know a lot of them are heading up the coast now or down the coast, the Margaret River, which is nice, but a lot of expats too. And I was surprised that the crowd supported New South Wales. Normally, Queensland's seen as the unfashionable but lovable underdog, but yep. It wasn't the case last night. There was more Blues fans than there the Maroons, which was... That helped. I really do believe it helps a team like New South Wales, and they were just up. You could tell from minute two of the game, Jared, sometimes you switch on, you think, uh-oh, and they knew that if they lost their game, they lost the series, they could leave nothing on the table. They went like complete madmen, and they deserved to win the game.
Was there a critical sin bin around halftime?
Yes, Felice Kaufusi was sent off for repeated infringements. The referee, Ashley Klein, apparently told the Queensland captain, Daly Cherry Evans, on the run, if you continue to give away penalties here, the next guy gets the bin. I thought it was a bit premature, but when you get thrashed like they were thrashed, you can't have too many complaints. And I thought that... Klein refereed it differently than he did the first game. The first game, there wasn't a penalty till about the 62nd minute, and there was barely a penalty in the game. This was a stronger touch from him last night. I didn't mind it. I didn't think it felt lost Queensland the game. But the whole narrative of Origin, Jared, is one of mystery and intrigue. Like the New South Wales had the meeting with the referee complaining about five errors in game one, and he refereed differently in game two. Queensland are simmering about that. So all these little things make it the fun that it is.
So it does set up a huge climax, doesn't it? Back in all in Queensland and all tied up. There's nothing quite like the decider in these circumstances.
Yeah. And this will sound like ridiculous logic, but it is the truth. Sometimes the more you push a team down the barrel in the game two, the more they bounce back in game three in Origin. Malcolm Knox, our old friend, wrote a great column about that a couple of years ago. He sort of said, oh, Queensland got slaughtered in this game. Don't worry, they'll win the decider at Suncorp. It'll just, the worse they played here, the better they'll play at Suncorp. And that has happened. Queensland have won eight of the last nine deciders at Suncorp Stadium. So they normally get there, the crowd gets them up, but this is a very good New South Wales team. When you've got a good kicking game in rugby league, you're just always in the game. Mm-hmm. And Queensland got beaten to a pulp in the forward pack. And, you know, the crowd will get them up, but, it will be compelling viewing, Jared.
All right. On a cricket front, Crash, what order should we do this? Maybe the end of the white ball series in Sri Lanka And I'm not sure, Barat joined me from Colombo on Thursday, and he told us twofold story. The first, just how desperate things are in that country right now. The queues for petrol that's not there, the queues for cooking gas, the sense that the country is absolutely on the brink of collapse. And then cricket, which is taking place with a full house and the sense of gratitude and relief that that offers. And we saw that materialise with a crowd reaction like I can't recall seeing, as Sri Lankans turned out almost in Australian gold, and a standing ovation and signs of thanks and gratitude that Australia was there, and just what cricket means to a community, even in the worst of times.
Yeah, and do you know what? It is hard to read, and sometimes even get the players wrong. The players get it wrong. I was speaking to a player before they left, and he actually said, you know, amongst the boys, there's a feeling that should we be, you know, lapping it up in five-star luxury when some people can't even afford petrol or daily, you know, grocery shopping in Sri Lanka. He said, it feels awkward. It feels that, you know, should we really be there? That mood has changed entirely to the polar opposite, where they're grateful to be contributing to the country. So it is, and the distress has filtered the way, all the way down through the Sri Lankan system. Their school cricket, which was once so strong and produced those gorgeous, technically correct batsmen like Mahela Jayawardena, is now struggling just to field, you know, constant teams, you know, play games away from home, which requires extra petrol. So it's really hitting them hard. So it's they were quite beautiful scenes.
Righto, so what happens next? Off to Gaul for a two-test series, and Glenn Maxwell is recalled to the squad. If Travis Head is not fit, he will make his test return. Here's Maxwell after being told that he was staying with the team and he had to dust off a baggy green that was in disrepair.
I feel like I've got a really good grasp on how the ball's coming out of my hand, and that's been probably one of the key things that I've been able to work on. And I think with the batting, I just feel really comfortable with me where my game's at the moment. I've been able to bat continually pretty well in these conditions, and my footwork's been reasonably crisp most of the time. And I'm certainly looking forward to the next couple of weeks. I've done a bit of red ball work, training-wise, and always trying to stay ready just in case. And knowing that there was a fair few subcontinent tours coming up, not just this year, but next year as well, just always getting ready just in case. And at some stage, you think you might give up hope, but it was just so nice to get the tap on the shoulder and I suppose have the faith that I can do the job for this team.
I hope he plays, Crash. I hope he plays.
Yeah, well, the latest report from this training session last night was that Travis Head did a few laps of the oval and batted without major discomfort. So those who saw it are now tipping Travis Head is more likely to play than not, which means Maxwell wouldn't play. But unlike you, Jerry, just for the sense of what's going to happen if Maxwell plays again. And we all know the narrative. We saw it this season with Usman Khawaja getting the late chance and coming in and scoring century after century. Sometimes that's the best way to be selected, when you expect nothing and suddenly skate in. And you and I just know Maxwell's got one big test innings in him in Sri Lanka if he gets the chance. He's more out of the team than in at the moment. But if Travis Head wakes up sore today or tomorrow, it's a different equation.
He's such a better bowling option than any of Head, Smith or Labuschagne. We expect these to be raging turners. He makes so much sense in that team. I know if he gets in, it's because of an injury, but I can make the case all day long that for team balance, he's a better option.
Yeah, it's the weirdest test career ever. Hasn't played a test for 5 years, basically given up on his red ball career, but would be chosen on white ball form and was always a better red ball batsman than he was given credit for, with a first-class average floating around 40. And that's really good for eight these days. And, you know, Glenn was probably the first player in Australia to prioritise white ball cricket, wasn't he? When the IPL came along and they plucked him with the big dollars, like he went that way. And it was at a cost to his test career, but it doesn't mean he can't play the test game. And the thought of him dusting off his motley baggy green cap, which has been in mothballs for 5 years, started the discussion, Jared, of the world's most moth-eaten baggy green cap.
Yes, yes.
Where does your mind go right now? Where does your mind go
Steve
right
Waugh?
Now? Yeah. I was going to say, Cricket Nuffy Me went back through the internet looking at old photos, and there was Steve Waugh with the front of his cap. You could see the white plastic in it where the green layers were peeling off, and he loved it that way. Sometimes players love the fact that their baggy green is falling apart because it meant they played so much. And I've known blokes that love sniffing their baggy green cap. And that's caps that have been had beer poured on them and everything. Yeah. But they smell the sweat, and the sweat takes them back to the middle. And the middle often reminds them of triumph. And it is the cult of the baggy green cap is not what it used to be, but it's still there. Yeah,
this sounded like a tale of mould and decay. Like that it didn't sound like a cap that's ready for active service.
No, exactly. But they used to get multiple caps, but now they sort of only get the one unless it's beyond repair. But look, it will be interesting. It's a fascinating team, Jared, this one, because Mitchell Starc, of course, has had a cut finger. Now, he took 11 wickets in a test at Gaul, and everyone's saying right now, oh, look, Gaul's a spinner's deck, and it is. But let's not remember this stat. Let's not forget this stat. Last year, Jimmy Anderson broke open a test at Gaul by taking 6 for 40 in the first innings. The ball does swing there. Starc's got swing before and got 11 wickets in a test. Like, the fast men can open them up if they're good enough in Gaul. So But Mitchell Starc's got a finger injury. He wasn't bowling in the nets. He's been told he cannot strap the injury. If he cuts it again in the game, then he can strap it. He's got a little bit of glue on it, I understand. Right. But it'll be fascinating to see whether he plays.
Are you expecting Swepson to be the second spinner?
Yeah, great question. They've said and said again that they prefer a finger spinner. So is that young Kuhneman from Queensland? Is it John Holland? I'm not sure, but Swepson, who has a stomach bug and is just recovering from it, he would be my choice. I'd give him one last go. Ashton Agar, who has a side strain, is a chance of the last test. But they say spinners don't take wickets here, but leg spinners. But Shane Warne has bowled beautifully there. It's just that Mattia Muralitharan averaged 10 wickets a test in Gaul. But it's a fascinating tour. I've got Swepson slightly ahead, but I wouldn't be stunned if it went the other way. But, Jared, Sri Lanka's interesting, isn't it, from Nathan Lyon. It was where he made his test debut, wicket first ball, but on the last tour, they sort of blamed him for everything that went wrong.
Yep.
And they were saying they said, look at Rangana Harath, Nathan. Look at the way he goes across the ball. You're going over the top of the ball. It can't work here. You know, so it was they had three different game plans for three different tests. Usman Khawaja said that last night in a presser. It was a fascinating tour.
So what are we expecting? So Gaul, it felt like it was seared into the subconscious of Dave Warner as diabolical. Anything short of a raging Turner and we would be surprised, wouldn't we?
Yeah, we would be. But the Australians know this. You can't just turn up and get wickets there, you know? Like, there's a skill to... Sometimes on turning wickets, you can get it completely wrong and go for a lot of runs. So Lyon, I think, has put a lot of work into coming to a style of bowling which is a little bit different to what he uses in Australia, where he goes over the top of the ball and gets bounce. In the subcontinent now, he goes a little bit around the ball and screws it sideways, and that's absolutely crucial. So it can be a hard ground to score runs on. Joe Root's got a very good test average there, but not a lot of overseas players have been especially good. Australia scored a few centuries there early in the century, But, yeah, Gaul generally equals turning conditions. And why would Sri Lanka prepare anything else?
Our SEN Test cricket team will be on the ground in Gaul, so Wednesday, 2:30 for the first ball of play. What are your expectations, Crash? This is a very good team that's just had success in Pakistan, but these are the least favoured conditions for Australia to play in, I think.
Yeah, I think Australia, they are, but it's tremendous practice for what they'll get in India next season in a four-test series that will define this team, I think. Imagine if they won that one. You can beat Sri Lanka in Sri Lanka. Australia has done it before. And England won a couple of tests at this very ground in Gaul in recent seasons by using their fast men to zip through early and then their spinners would pounce late. So that's got to be the game plan. You'd love to win the toss. You know, nothing will be easier to bat than the first day. But if Australia have to bowl, there's generally that little sea breeze and there's a lot of emotions playing in Gaul. It's got the hotel, Jared, that was one of the favourite hotels in the world for the players, the Lighthouse Hotel, which was swamped by the tsunami. Incredible, really. They, when the tsunami hit Sri Lanka, the Lighthouse was one of the venues which completely went under. It took them ages to get back and start again, and there was all sorts of stories about that.
Yeah, we'll hear those stories during our broadcast, I'm sure. Have you toured there, Crash?
Yeah, I did. I toured for Shane Warne's comeback from a drug ban tour just after in 2004, and it was just majestic because Warne would take five wickets in an innings, then Miralidhaman would take five wickets in an innings. And Warne came back, and he just said to the chairman of selectors, Trevor Hones, I'll be right. And Hones watched him bowl at a private session before he picked him for the tour after his year ban and just said, mate, I saw him bowl two balls and you know what? He's still got it. He said, he'll be actually, for this year off, he'll be better. And he almost was. He was so good on that tour. He just kept on bowling and matching merrily, five for five for. And gee, it was great to watch. I mean, that's spin bowling in Sri Lanka has got a charm all of its own. I always felt it was, and I know Peter Lawler considers it the most underrated tour in the world. I so agree. It's a majestic place to tour. It's sort of like India, but not quite as populated. And it's beautiful, some of the venues.
I'm sure it'll sound great from Wednesday. The wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock on a Monday. We'll talk that other test series, which is coming to a close. A day left, England look poised to win it 3-0. A little bit of Wimbledon, and we'll stray further with Crash coming up next. Melbourne's weather, partly cloudy and a top of 13 for City Power upgrades, keeping electricity in Melbourne's CBD reliable. The wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock on a Monday for Tyre Power this season. Your best clubman is your local owner-operator from Tyre Power, your trusted tyre experts. The other one on Cricket, Crash, is England needs a further 113 runs on day five at Headingley with eight wickets in hand to win the series against New Zealand 3-0.
Jared, this is the best story in cricket. They went 16 tests and won one of them before Ben Stokes was appointed captain and key with his Brendan McCullum coach, and together they've completely reinvigorated this team. They scored at an average of 5.5 runs an over in the first innings of this test. That's not England. That hasn't been England for 150 years.
Yes.
My goodness me. And they're playing Cavalier cricket, Brendan McCullum cricket. Can they keep it up? I'm not sure. But Johnny Bairstow, two hurricane centuries in two tests. They've found something inside his head that has been unlocked and unleashed. And it's such an interesting story because, you know, Johnny's had a tough life. He was 8 years old when he came home and found his father dead after committing suicide. David Bairstow, of course, was a former English keeper. Now, what that would do to a young mind, I wouldn't know, but Johnny's always had an element of being unsettled, and suddenly he's put together these two beautiful test matches. Gee, it's great viewing, I have to say.
It's been every bit of that, and think about what it does to Australia versus England. So there are one-dayers in November that I think will be far more interesting than they were otherwise going to be, and then the Winter Ashes next year with those two in charge for what has been, you know, a hopelessly lopsided summer here. It'll be reinvigorated.
Oh, it will be an England team, a white ball team, coached by Matthew Mott, Australia's own. So that'll be interesting in itself. But I have to say this, I don't rate England's top three, but I think they're going to struggle against Cummins and the likes in the test next year. But Ollie Pope is finding form, which is interesting because he's got a great first-class average. Jack Leach has just taken his first 10 for in a test. I mean, so it's just... When England are up, cricket is up.
Yes.
And I just hope it's this most rousing contest next season. To me, they'll be trapped between eras next year because Broad and Anderson will just be saying goodbye, and I'm not sure who'll be around to say hello. But it'll be... but something's brewing, and Brendan McCullum, their coach, has just got this way, and it starts at his body language where he sort of walks slowly and with a bit of an amiable sort of... gated, like a farmer out expecting his pineapple crop, you know? And it just, he relaxes people in the dressing room. It's a nice place to start for a cricket coach.
All right, tennis and golf with Crash next. Every ball live on the ground from Gaul. So that'll be great listening from Wednesday afternoon. The tennis starts tonight at Wimbledon. Crash, is where will Ash Barty be while this is going ahead?
She'll be on her way to America, Jared, to play in the Icons Golf Series with the likes of Ricky Ponting and AB de Villiers. But she had an amazing experience last week when her childhood tennis centre, the really unpretentious West Brisbane Tennis Centre, closed down and was sold, changed hands Thursday. But she said to her childhood coach, Jim Joyce, I have to be the last one to hit a ball at it. So just before dusk, for an hour and a half on Wednesday, there they were, just the two of them on this old court, on which she was famously photoed in that as a six-year-old holding her first tennis trophy. Everyone who listening to this show would have seen that photo. And it went on and on. Then finally, Jim said, right, that's enough. And they came to the net. You think of this, the current Wimbledon champion driving through Industrial Archerfield on the way to this old court. And she had to be the last person to hit. And when she got to the net, they had a hug and she started crying, and so did he. And I thought that said so much about her. Like, she said, Jim, I'm so appreciative to everything you've done for me. He was the guy who taught her the slice backhand that Jim Courier said was Roger Federer-esque, you know? Mm. And just picture that, you know, as the girls are getting ready for Wimbledon on the other side of the globe, she said, oh, can I souvenir the tennis net? I know it's got a hole in it, but this is the last shot she ever played was a backhand that found the net. That was at 5:15. The sun was just going down and they undid the squeaky tennis net. Jared, who doesn't know that sound? And she said, I'm taking this net home and I'll never part with it.
What becomes of those courts, Crash? Are they building on them? What's happening?
Yes, I believe they are. And they've been there for 52 years. I mean, and as she stood there, she looked around and she said, all of these courts have got a memory for me. That one over there is where I hit my first ball as a four-year-old. That one was where the men used to play. And Jim said, right, I know you're only 12 years old, but I want you to start playing men, you know. And see, this one was my first fixture. So she keeps her emotions, Ash, buried very deep inside her. You don't really see them. And they did not want any media there at those courts. That was just the two of them standing there. And they hit for an hour and a half. And the old coaching Jim stirred, Jared. Yep. Like he'd occasionally say, punch through it, please. Punch through it. I mean, she's retired. She's won 3 Grand Slams.
That's a beautiful image.
I know I'm going on about it, but this is the current defending Wimbledon champion we're talking about. And in this lovely little unpretentious tennis court where there's chickens out the back, they keep chickens there, and occasionally, you know, amazing, but she's never lost touch with her roots. She's always said, where would I be without the Joyce family? She texted Jim this series of dates saying, we have to be the last ones to hit on it. Here's my schedule. Come on, let's fit it in. And, she turned up, and a week before she turned up as well to present trophies and spent half an hour talking to Jim's brother, who's a Carlton fan, about Carlton and Richmond. So, you know, but, yeah, I must say, Jared, it's the great stories in sport sometimes aren't always the grand finals. Sometimes they're hidden away on the back streets of Archerfield.
Yeah, yeah. That the absence of Barty from this Wimbledon is going to be pretty profound for us from tonight. So there'll be a couple of rounds of Kyrgios, I imagine, but think back to how last year's tournament transfixed us the longer that it went. It's hard to imagine getting the same thrill from it this year.
It is. It really is. And I think that, in the men's draw, it'll be interesting. Djokovic is $1.80. So people are sort of thinking he can go one extra, narrow the gap to one behind Rafael Nadal in the all-time list of most major winners. But you're right. Ash Barty, it's often said, isn't it, that having influence, the great influence in life, often don't even know they're influential. Mm. Like when Ash Barty retired, it completely changed the landscape of the Australian sports television rights. You know, Channel 7 were going to give away cricket and have a snatch at the tennis. Then they suddenly thought, oh, is it really worthwhile without Ash? I mean, it's not worth what we're going to pay for it, is it? So everything changed when she retired. The ripples are still being felt around the world. But I will say this. One of the things she's done is empower people with the power to be themselves and make bold decisions. She is still getting emails from people who said, you know, I've been working the same job for 30 years and I thought I'm not brave enough to make a change. When you retired from tennis, I thought, actually, if Ash can be that bold to stand down and retire when she's a world number one, I'm going to move to a new job.
Yeah. Yep. The ripple effects there. Hey, last one for you, Crash. Since last we spoke, Brooks Koepka has confirmed he's going to live to the Live series. And there's a really interesting discussion happening in the States now, which has sort of finally gained traction as to whether Live is winning the war with the USPGA. And the USPGA, which was just going to stand on its digs and rely on tradition and the clout that it's had, just seems to be giving ground, particularly with the majors so far, allowing them to play. How do you read Koepka's signing?
Oh, I was stunned because only 4 days before it, he'd had a press conference saying, will you stop asking me about LIV Golf? You know, it's cluttering the air. It's providing a bad stench. And then he joins them and he must have signed before that press conference. He must have knew what was coming up. To me, he's been battling injuries for a couple of years after winning four majors in very quick time. And like a lot of these guys, I think he can sense that he's not quite what he was. But I'm still staggered he signed with them. The PGA have responded by putting four or five $20 million tournaments as if to say, hey, guess what we've got here? But I understand there's still more big names to come, and they're personality players, Jared. Golf is different from other sports. Like, it's not like Masters tennis or anything like that. Phil Mickelson, DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, and these guys are massive draw cards. They are massive draw cards, no matter what field they're playing in. So they've damaged the PGA, and the PGA is hurting, and they're thinking, and they're replanning. I think golf will emerge much stronger, but I don't know how long Liv will last. All it would take was for the Saudi Arabian royal family to decide, no, we won't have a snatch at golf, and they could just disappear in a season. But by the time that happens, a lot of people will have made a lot of cash.
Yeah, so the divide will be, it'll be deep and wide for at least that period of time.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I heard you say last time we were on, you said, I can't stop reading about this, and I'm the same. Like, just sports wars are so intriguing because, here's one. There was a story the other day, what players have said 6 months ago and now.
Right.
And had all these players like Brooks Koepka saying, not for me, Dustin Johnson. Oh, no, wouldn't even think about it. Then suddenly they've signed.
Yeah, yeah. And just that idea of if you can play the majors, then what are you actually giving up? Those tournaments in between.
That's it. See, that's it. That's the whole thing. Sure, it may hurt their world ranking if Liv doesn't count for world ranking points, but if you've got big exemptions and you play in the majors for 4 or 5 years, you're not losing much at all. Mm. These blokes, it's not like you're travelling around with a tour with a group of mates in a footy team where you love their company and you love the whole vibe. A lot of these guys, you know, they're soldiers of fortune just getting around by themselves or maybe with one coach. They find it really lonely. They'd very, very happily play 9 times a year plus the majors. And if we had Adam Scott on the show and you said, hand over your heart, do you like the live schedule? I bet he'd say something like, 9 tournaments a year plus the majors is heaven for me.
Yes.
I never wanted to play much more than that anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Great, Crash. Terrific. Enjoy the cricket when it starts on Wednesday night for Australia, Wednesday afternoon.
Can't wait, Jared. Thanks a lot.
The wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock on a Monday.